There we go.
Tuesday night Bible study on Romans. We're going to do the second half of chapter 1, so 1B I'll call it. And by the way, I have had four people who have asked me for copies of the audio recording. I still don't know where or how to post it on our new website. I got to talk to Fred Pietlow about that. So for now, I just have them on my computer. So if you need an audio copy because you miss a week and you want one, just send me an email to my personal email address, martymeisel@gmail.com, because my church email address I'm still having problems with. Christine got back into hers. I still haven't got back into mine, so I don't know what's going on. So anyway, brief recap where we were. Let me get this picture down from the screen and call up our where we were. I'll maximize that. There we are. Romans chapter 1. So last week we talked about this little post-greeting opening from Paul, his longing to go to Rome, verses 8 through 15. He wants to visit them, but he cannot at this time, but he prays for them constantly. And that's a big deal. You know, to pray for one another is absolutely important. And he'll mention that a little bit later on and more near the end of the letter. And then we spent some time on these couple of verses 16 and 17. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. This is not quite centered here, is it? Let me fix this. There, is that better? Yeah. Slightly smaller. Is it okay? You can't see it?
Got off the timing.
Pardon?
It seemed to have gotten smaller when we did that.
Yeah. Let me make it there. Does that help a little bit? You know what might hit, although the front pair of lights are already off. Okay. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. This is the theme verse of the whole letter. And this is entirely what Paul is talking about and what all of Christian doctrine centers on. And this was very influential with Martin Luther, if you remember that as well. So it's all about the gospel. Paul is not ashamed of the gospel. And the gospel, which is the good news about Jesus Christ, that's kind of in a nutshell what we would say the gospel is, think of John 3:16, is powerful. It is the power of God for salvation. And it's for everyone. Remember, that's one of the secondary themes of the book of Romans. It's for everyone, Jews and Greeks. That's an attempt or a way to explain everybody. And then verse 17 here, and this is very briefly, just a recap, caused a lot of consternation for Martin Luther. For in it being a reference to the gospel, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. Now what does that mean, righteousness of God? In Greek, that little word of is just as ambiguous as it is in English. So the way teachers or scholars at the time of Martin Luther taught, what they taught was that the righteousness of God is talking about a description of the holiness of God. God's holiness and perfection. And therefore the righteousness of God is that God in his holiness and perfection has to be judgmental over sin. Because he's righteous, he has to judge sin. Now that's true. But what this does is by understanding it that way, you're saying, well, that's the point of the gospel. The point of the gospel, for in it, the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. So Luther was very much perplexed and I would say downcast because it was all about seemingly the wrath of God against sin. And it's revealed from faith for faith. So your faith is developed by knowing God's wrath against your sin. Now, all of you, being Lutheran, you know, if you were to hear that today being taught or preached in our church, the little bells in your head would be going off, because that's not at all what we teach. And Luther was in a lot of consternation about this until two things. He realized one of the early church fathers taught differently, and that was St. Augustine. Absolutely, Luther was a student of Augustine, even though they lived 1,200 years apart. And the second thing is, he looked up this quote. Paul is quoting here from Habakkuk, the righteous shall live by faith. And actually the full quote there is, the righteous shall live by his faith. I don't know if you remember, we looked that up last week. And so after studying that and what Augustine had to say, Luther realized that the righteousness of God, that term, is not primarily a reference to God's holiness and his wrath against unholiness or sin, but it's rather a description of the righteousness that comes from God. The righteousness you have, which comes from God. And how does it come from God? First of all, it's revealed through the gospel, and it comes from God from faith. For faith. So in order to receive that righteousness that comes from God imparted upon you, you need to have faith. And when you receive that righteousness from God, it strengthens you in faith. So now you can receive the righteousness again, which then strengthens you in faith again. So remember I talked about kind of a circle there. You have faith, so you receive righteousness, which strengthens you in faith so that you can receive more righteousness. One way to think of it is forgiveness. You know, righteousness is forgiveness, the righteousness of God. That completely opened Luther's eyes and mind to understand this properly, what Paul was talking about, and that completely changed his approach to the entire Bible. That's kind of how Luther got on to the recognition that the entire Bible is filled with both law and gospel, and they are separate. Law is God's wrath against sin. Gospel is God's forgiveness for sinners. And this opened his eyes to that. All right, well, that was a few minutes, more than a few minutes perhaps. Recap from last week. Any questions from about that or last week? Yeah, Terry.
How does that relate to Abraham's faith was counted as righteousness?
Well, that's very related to this. Because how is it that Paul says you receive righteousness from God? From faith. And the point that is made about Abraham, I think it's in the book of Hebrews, is that Abraham was not counted as righteous or declared righteous because of anything he did. Even though he was obedient to God in multiple ways, he was counted as righteous because he believed God's promise of a coming Messiah. His faith in a coming Messiah is why he was declared righteous by God.
It's actually in chapter 4 of Romans.
Oh, it's in chapter 4 of Romans. Yeah, it's coming up here too. Okay, yeah, you're right. It is coming up. So that's how it would relate, because Abraham was righteous not because of his obedience, which he was. He was righteous because of his faith. And that's how you and I are righteous too, which is wonderful, because I am willing to guess, it's more than a guess, I am willing to know that all of you, like myself, sometimes are obedient to God and sometimes are not, right? How true that is for all of us. So it's a good thing our righteousness is not dependent upon our obedience. All right, God's wrath on unrighteousness. Okay, we'll go on. We're going to finish chapter 1 today. At least that's my plan. I think we can do it. All right, the next paragraph. I'll read verses 18 through 23, and then we'll go back and talk about each verse. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Okay, so now Paul, for the next couple of chapters, is going to launch into an extended discussion of the problem between us and God. The problem of our relationship. And you know the problem. It's sin. So these next couple of chapters, he's laying the groundwork to saying, here's the problem. Problem is sin. And he begins right off the bat, for the wrath of God. Now see, that's different than the righteousness of God. So here again, that reinforces Luther's insight into the previous two verses. For the wrath of God, God's displeasure, judgment, unhappiness with sin is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. All right, so the wrath of God, first of all, that can mean two things. One, the wrath of God is his anger. God is, that's a part of his character. He is angry against sin. You know, when we say we should fear God, you know, half of that fear is be afraid of God because he is angry against sin and we all have sin within us. The other half of that phrase, wrath of God, is meaning the results. In other words, because God is wrathful or angry with sin, therefore, he has to do something. He has to punish sin, or else he wouldn't be righteous. So the wrath of God, or the punishment that comes as a result of our sin, is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. So, how is the punishment or judgment of God against sin revealed? It says it's revealed from heaven. How is that revealed? Maybe just a quick thought from one or more of you, if you have some thoughts. How does God reveal his displeasure with sin?
He allows tragedies to happen.
Yes, he allows tragedies to happen. Exactly right. Any other thoughts?
Death?
Yes. He allows death to happen too. Absolutely right. All of us, we have to go through death unless Jesus comes again.
Illness?
Yeah, sure. Illness. Right. Basically, you could say any bad consequence of a sinful action of ours. Could God just wipe away all the sinful consequences? You know, you do something stupid, you say an insult to a friend, a spouse, or somebody, and it causes a rift in your relationship, okay? There's a common thing, happens all the time. We offend one another by saying something stupid. I know it happens from me to my wife all the time. So, that happens all the time. Could God just wipe away those results and kind of cover it over and make sure everything is right? Yeah, he could. But he doesn't. He does prevent a lot of the bad consequences of sin from happening. But he allows some of them to actually occur. Why does he do that? To train us, to teach us, to scold us, to discipline us, to strengthen us. To make us aware. I mean, all kinds of reasons, right? It's kind of like, again, kind of the parenting analogy, because it works so well from God to us is the same as us to children. How sometimes a child, let me make up an example. They get a brand new toy, and then they do something stupid and lose it, or it gets accidentally flushed down the toilet, or thrown in the garbage, or something bad happens, and they're all crying. Because they just lost their brand new toy. Do you go out and buy another one to replace it right away? Maybe, depends on the circumstances, but I think I would generally be more inclined to say, well, that's the consequence of you not taking care of your toy. So then they have to learn a lesson from that, right? God does that with us sometimes. All right? So, yes, the wrath of God or his judgment against sin is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. And why? Because we suppress the truth. We suppress the truth. What is the truth? Well, there's a lot of parts of the truth. The truth is God is angry against sin. And the main part that we suppress here that's being referenced is that we can ignore that. Ignore that sin. It's no big deal. God will overlook it. He forgives it anyway. Everybody's doing it. My neighbor made me do it. The devil made me do it. Don't worry about it. We diminish and belittle the sin in our lives. It's not a big deal. We try to make it as though it doesn't matter. Right?
In our society nowadays, some of it, they even don't acknowledge the sin anymore.
Yes, and I would say even worse, and we're going to hear that at the end of this chapter. It's part of this kind of extended passage. Not only in our society is sin ignored, but sin is also promoted as being good. So let's talk about upside down. You know, Yeah, go sleep with your neighbor, it doesn't matter. That's fun, everybody's doing it, right? You know, that kind of attitude, which you see that in the movies all the time, right? It's promiscuity. Okay, anyway, more about that, those topics coming up. Verses 19 and 20. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. So first of all, some people say, and I have heard this, and it's a valid, you know, pondering. How can God punish somebody if they don't know they're sinning? How can you punish a child if you don't tell them it's wrong and they shouldn't do it to begin with? Well, that's a valid question to pose. Here's part of the answer. Here's half of the answer. Everybody knows God exists. Deep down in your heart of hearts, in the middle of your soul, in the middle of your mind, everybody knows God exists. Because God has made it plain. He has shown himself his invisible attributes through creation. Okay? This right here is, well, to use a fancy term, for us Lutherans, these two verses are a sedis doctrinae, which means they're a foundational doctrine that everyone, or let me say it the other way, no one has an excuse to say on judgment day, but God, I didn't know that was a sin. I didn't even know you existed. No one has that because we can see God's character in creation itself. Now how? Here's a little question. Let's ask how. Well, first of all, before I do that, I make note of a pun. There's a pun here in the Greek and in the English too. His invisible attributes are clearly perceived. God's invisible characteristics can be seen. You see the pun? It's not a laugh out loud pun, but it's just kind of like, oh yeah, that's kind of a twist of words. And I think Paul probably intended that anyway. So God has invisible attributes, many invisible attributes, okay? And they are clearly seen in creation. Can you brainstorm with me a few? I just thought up about 6 or 7 and I threw them in my notes real quick. What are some of the invisible attributes you see in creation that make it plain that God exists?
Order.
Order? Is that what I heard?
Yes.
Yes. Order, absolutely. Things are structured, seasons, right? The sun, the moon, there's an order to things. Yes, that's one way, absolutely.
The good that comes out of bad.
Okay, something bad happens and something good comes out of it that you might not have expected. Right.
He's almighty.
He's almighty? Yes, and I'll build on that a little bit more because that was a couple of my own thoughts that I put in here. Have any of you ever seen the Rocky Mountains or Appalachian Mountains during a sunset or a sunrise? They are so majestic. To see the sun rise or set behind the mountain and the stars begin to peek out, does that happen by chance? That majesty, that almightiness, I don't think so.
I'm always impressed by every sunset.
Yeah, right. I get a little tired sometimes of my wife saying, let's drive out to the lake and look at the sunset. She can tell from the street in front of our yard, she says, because there's a gap in the trees there. I said, oh, look at it, it's turning purple and pink. Let's go out to the lake and see the sunset, which we do quite often. And then we've gotten used to measuring. Okay, we've got 5 minutes to go until it sets. You know, can't use that hand measurement. Yeah, here's another one, too. Thinking of storms. If you see a storm, and, you know, hopefully you're in a safe place, but you see the power, the absolute destructive power of a storm. You know, you see it on the news, maybe a hurricane or a tornado. That shows the destructive power that God has against sin. Okay, so that reveals his invisible characteristic too.
I have a question about that. Maybe we can take it up after class.
Sure.
From the Large Catechism about storms.
Okay.
Writing of Luther that I don't understand.
Okay, all right. Well, if you want to talk about that after, we can. Sure, that's fine. Here's another one. The beauty and the delicateness of a flower. A flower that's just perfect. Say a rose. And it's just opening up. And you see how delicate it is and how beautiful it is. It's a sign of God's beauty. God's understanding and appreciation of beauty. How about this one? See, I'm just rattling them off. How about this one? The miracle of life. A child is born. Or, like in our case, we had kittens born. Not recently. A couple of months ago. Life! You know, doctors, scientists today still cannot explain how the spark of life begins. You know, you've got a male here and a female here, and somehow, I mean, we know the mechanics, but we don't know the biology of the chemistry. All of a sudden, there's life. Brand new life, and it grows, and it comes forth. Frankly, that's a modern miracle. Can you think, is there any more that come to mind after I've just kind of been talking about all that?
Graciousness of letting us share that with
him. Yes. Sure, that God gives us all of those things, all of creation, that shows his grace. Exactly right. Exactly right. So see, this shows God's majesty, it shows God's power, it shows God's miracle, it shows God's grace, it shows God's order, it shows his almightiness. Here's another one that I just kind of saw from afar recently. The gentle touch of a mother soothing her baby. Right? Just seeing that. Does God do that with us? Does God have gentleness with us? Soothing touch with us? Yeah. Comfort? That shows God's characteristic right there. We could probably go on for a while. So, creation itself reveals God's invisible characteristics, his invisible attributes. So, no one is without, no one has an excuse. They are without excuse. Now, this doesn't explain God revealing himself through creation does not explain how God saves us. For that, you need to know about Jesus. But it does reveal that God exists. Yes.
When you talked about God and sin, some people, yeah, they believe in God, but it's a God.
Yeah, right.
How do they know when they sin that it's wrong even though it's a God?
Yeah, I think they do. We're going to hear about that in chapter 2 of Romans. You know, pretty much every culture in the history of mankind, you know, the Aborigines in Australia, the natives in Africa, the jungle people in Southeast Asia, they all understand that God exists. Now, most of them have a false notion of who God is, and they need somebody to set them straight on who the true God is and tell them about Jesus, hence the need for missionaries. But they know God exists, and they know sin exists, to answer your question, Pat. So, yes, no one has an excuse. Everyone knows. Now, what about atheists today, like in Western culture, which is really the only place atheism kind of exists? Okay. What about atheists who say, oh, there's no such thing as a God. I believe in science, not mystic religion. I think what they do, people who have that type of understanding, are suppressing the truth within their own mind. That deep down in their soul, they know God exists and they're suppressing it. They're burying it. They're ignoring it. That's what he's talking about back a verse there prior in verse 18. They suppress the truth about God's existence.
Well, they'll okay. also talk about, like you say, when they say science, but they'll call it nature.
Yeah.
Then they don't realize to me they're really talking about God.
Yes.
They don't want to call it God, but if they call it nature, it's okay.
Right. And then some of them actually go so far as to then kind of quasi-worshipping nature.
Right.
That it's all about nature, you know, preserving nature. Well, we do want to preserve nature, but because nature comes from God. Not because nature is our source of godliness. Right. All right. Verse 21. For although they knew God, see there it is, past tense, they knew God existed, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. So right there it is. You ignore God, you ignore the existence of God, even though you might not know who he is, or you might be worshiping the wrong God, so you need to be corrected in that. But if you ignore God long enough, you don't honor him, you don't give thanks to him, your heart becomes darkened. You see it right there in verse 21? And they become futile in their thinking. To me, this screams today in modern America of evolution. As some of you know, I've done a fair amount of reading and study on creation versus evolution. I think some of you have been to the Creation Museum. By the way, we'll go on another trip next summer, and I'll pick a better hotel too.
We did okay.
But we didn't get, we only saw the Ark. We didn't get to see the Creation Museum, so I want to do that. I want to take my own family to see the Creation Museum too. I've been there a couple times. But evolution, I think, is a futile attempt to explain the origin of the world. It's futile. Now, what does it mean to be futile? I pondered this, actually. I looked the word up in the Greek, because that's a kind of an unusual word. We don't use that too much, do we? Futile. What does futile mean?
A waste of time.
A waste of time. What was that, Rich?
Being a Lions fan.
Being a Lions fan, yes. A Lions fan is futile, yes. Filled with futileness. Yes, absolutely true. I even had some local Bears fans here. I don't know if this was you, Rich, but, well, I'll name names. Phil Cole, who's a Bears fan. And I said, so when the Lions are playing the Packers, who do you root for as a Bears fan? And he said, oh, the Lions all the way. Because, you know, we hate the Packers, and the Lions will eventually lose anyway, so. For anybody listening on the video, I'm a Lions fan, or sort of, if I can claim that, with a bag over my head. All right. Yes, futile. Went useless. A waste of time. Why bother? I was trying to think of some examples of futility in my own mind, and here's an example of futility. Well, you know, we just had a hurricane hit down in Florida, and there's another hurricane that's forming and coming up, and this is hurricane season. So, you know, when I think I build my new house here in Michigan, I'm going to build a hurricane-proof house here in Michigan. Now, that'd be rather futile, wouldn't it? Because by the time any hurricane gets all the way through the country up to Michigan, all that's left is a rainstorm. To build a hurricane-proof house would kind of be a waste of time and money. Right?
Global warming. You better watch
it. Yeah, right. You gotta beware of that. You'd be much more useful with your time and money in building a house in Michigan to build one that was, you know, energy efficient against snow and cold than you would against a hurricane. You know, it's futile.
Isn't futile almost like continuing the same behavior, thinking you're gonna get different results, or
that might be part of futility, sure.
Going through what you're going through, but then you don't change your behavior.
Yeah, I think that would be either part of or related to being futile. Yeah, futility. I agree. So I think what he's referring to here, though, a little more plainly in verse 21, they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. They tried to explain the world and the origin of the world and the existence of creation without God. That's futile. Because you can't do it. And I can punch all kinds of holes in the theory of evolution, just from my reading and from the museum and all that stuff, and scientists can't explain it. Those atheist evolutionary scientists, they say, well then why are there, you know, fossils of marine creatures at the tops of mountains? Well, I don't know. But I believe evolution. Well, you know, there's kind of a hypocrisy right there. You believe in evolution, yet evolution cannot explain all the details of creation. It cannot. So it's a futile attempt to explain the origin of the world. And I think that's what he's talking about here. And by the way, they didn't call it evolution. They didn't have the theory of evolution. But there were similar ideas back in Greek philosophical thought back at the time of Paul. that they try to explain things outside of the existence of God. They try to explain things without God. So this futility in thinking existed back then too. Okay? And their foolish hearts were darkened. Alright, going on. Verse 22. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. Again, that goes along with the futility. Oh yeah, I know how creation came to be. Oh yeah, I know the whole proper truth of things in the world. And they claim to be wise, but in fact they're foolish because they're trying to explain things without God.
This is common in theology.
Yeah.
In the church, in the Christian church, I think that sometimes theologians become too smart for their own good and they start making stuff up, or they discount the word of God and say, no, that's not how it goes, you know, that, you know, Paul can't possibly be right on this homosexuality question.
Right.
And so they wander off into futility.
Yeah.
In my estimation.
It does happen in theology and in the church too, where we try to explain things, outside of the Bible, God's Word.
And we become darkened, and we become fools.
And exactly. Yeah. So I think you're right, Glenn. This applies not just in philosophy, it applies not just in, you know, the origins of the world, but it applies also in some corners of theology as well. All right. And 20, verse 23, and exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. So yes, exchanging what is truly glory and immortal for simple statues of idols. Okay, so he is talking about idols here. So that is kind of one of the problems of sin is, well, honestly, I'm going to say the core problem of sin is idolatry. The foundation of all sin is idolatry. What is the first commandment? Yeah, you shall have no other gods. What's the problem with humanity? We have other gods, right? And even though we like to think, and I'm going to say this is kind of a modern day thing, oh, we don't have idols, we don't worship those little statues made out of stone or gold. We're not like that. We don't worship the trees like they did back in those cultures, you know, back 2 millennia ago. We're not like that. Au contraire, Martin Luther says, did I write it down here in my notes? Or I'll have to paraphrase it. Some of you know this. Luther says, a God is that to which we look for all good and in which we find refuge in every need. So, we may not have idols like of old, of images resembling mortal man, birds, animals, or creeping things, but we do have idols today. What are some of the idols today?
Money.
Money's a big one. Absolutely. Money is a big idol, especially in our culture. What else?
Ourselves.
Yeah, ourselves. That was Adam and Eve's original idol. They idolized themselves. They wanted to be like God. Frankly, that's all of us. Every time you're disobedient or rebellious against God, it's because you want yourself to be in the place of God. So you're idolizing yourself. What else?
Fame. Look at all the reality TV shows where people get on TV and, you know, become famous.
And not just the reality TV shows, but all the social networking, YouTube, TikTok. Oh, look at me. And, you know, that's, I'll tell you guys, you know, I know there is some good that can come out of Facebook. But I deleted my whole Facebook account a little while ago. Just because it's all about me. Oh, look at what I had for dinner tonight. I'm posting that on Facebook. Yeah. Right? Now, truth, families that are spread apart, somebody's on the one coast, somebody's on the other coast, somebody's overseas, whatever, you can connect on Facebook, that is a good thing. Okay? So I don't doubt that. But that's not my situation. And I just get tired of the, look at me attitude. Okay? So yes, we idolize ourselves.
Everybody has a God.
Oh, everybody has a God, besides the true God. Multiple gods besides the true God. Is that what you mean?
Yes. It's alcohol, it's someone you love, or it's
Alcohol, yes. Love or affection, you know, you're always grabbing on to people.
We're programmed to worship.
Yes, we are.
We want to worship
something. That is a good point. Deep in our human nature, we want to worship something. You're right. We need to channel that, have that channel to the true God. You know, we could worship chocolate. Who does that? Alcohol, yes, that's a big one. Another big one that I put on my little thought list just for my notes here is electronic gadgets. Is that, you know, my kids, you know, when they get, oh, we want this video game system. Well, okay, you know, next Christmas, okay, we get it for them. And then what happens a year later? Oh, we want that other one that's better. We just got you that one a year ago. You hardly play those games anymore. Well, now we want to play that one with those games. So you want the next and best, right? Isn't that true for all of us? Cell phones, TVs, you know, that kind of thing.
We rely upon those electric things a lot of times for security.
Yes, we do. There's another idol, security, right? We want to feel safe, so we want to protect ourselves. And one more that I see more and more, unfortunately, and that is laziness or leisure. We don't want to have to put in the hard work that might be necessary to gain something that we want. Okay, all right, anyway. Enough of that. There's lots of idols, even though it's not actual statues of men and birds and animals and creeping things. All right, verse 24. Verse 24 and 25. Therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. All right, so God gave them up. Here's an interesting thing. I'll just point this out to you. We're going to talk about it more over the next couple of verses. Look at verse 24. God gave them up. Look at verse 26. God gave them up. Look at verse 28, halfway through. God gave them up. Three times in six verses, Paul says, God gave them up. What does that mean?
Freedom of choice.
He allowed them to choose and pursue their own sinful desires. Right? He gave them up. He said, this is what you really want? Are you sure? Are you really, really sure? You sure that's what you want to do? You sure? Okay, I'll give you what you want. That's what God does. People have asked me sometimes, and here's our Lutheran answer, so this is part of what we teach. If God is a good God, which He is, why does He send anyone to hell? Why is there such a thing as hell? Why wouldn't God just save everybody? And my answer is, because some people choose to go to hell. It's their own choice. What happens is, somebody says, you know what, I don't believe in you, God. Even though down in your conscience, nobody has an excuse. We all know God exists. I don't believe in you, God. I don't want you in my life. I don't want to be part of that church. I don't want to be part of those Christians. They're a bunch of crazies. No, I want to do my own thing. I want to live my life the way I want. I don't want to live according to your commandments, God. And God says, are you sure? You sure? Really? I'm here for you. I love you. He tries to get his message through. God is patient. He tries over and over again. He tries for hundreds of years with his people in the Old Testament. He tries for a lifetime with all of us. And eventually, if somebody says at the end of their life, yep, I'm sure, I don't want you, God, eventually God says, okay, then I will put you in a place in eternity where I don't exist. That place is called hell. So God eventually gives them up. So that's what's happening here. He gave them up. So, verse 24, therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. Now, yes, there is a hint of sexual improprieties here. But he doesn't say yet what those sexual improprieties are. Promiscuity, for instance. He's about to use homosexuality as an example. We'll get to that in the next short little paragraph there. But, yes, dishonoring of their bodies through promiscuity, which does dishonor your body. It's not according to God's will. But there are other ways that in our sinful hard-heartedness that we dishonor our bodies. How else do we do that?
Overeating.
Yes, overeating. Boy, you hit home, don't you? Boy. So I shouldn't have had that second helping of mostaccioli tonight that my wife made from scratch that was delicious? No, I probably shouldn't have. Yes, overeating dishonors our bodies. What else? Drinking too much.
Drugs.
Yep. Smoking, maybe too much. I don't know. Addiction, basically any addiction. That, you know, use the drinking one. Did God create alcohol? Yes. Can it be used in a good way? Yes. Jesus turned water into wine. Remember my Bible study? 5 upstanding godly uses of wine in the Bible. However, can alcohol be misused and abused and addicted? Yes. That dishonors your body. Same thing with food. Does God want us to enjoy our food? Sure. But should we be gluttons or, you know, pigs? Eat too much? No, that's dishonoring your body. So a lot of these cases, you know, I would say for the case of drugs, medicinal drugs, are they good for certain uses, for certain purposes? Yes. But if you become addicted to painkillers, for instance, painkillers are good after surgery, but if you become addicted to them, you're dishonoring your body. However, I will say that primarily because Paul uses the word lust of their hearts, he uses the word impurity, and he uses dishonoring of their bodies, he's primarily thinking of sexual sins here. Okay? Even though those other ways of dishonoring your body are in view, but that's not primarily what he's referring to. And so, we harm our bodies because we exchange the truth of God for a lie and worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. And for most of us, the creature that we worship is no longer, you know, the cat statue or the golden calf or the little statue of some kind of man or woman. The creature that we most often worship is, you know it, right? Ourselves. Ourselves. And then he's got a little doxology here. Rather than the creator, who is blessed forever, amen. Throws that in there, just kind of, frankly, I don't know why. I didn't look it up or research it, but I don't know why he kind of threw that little mini doxology in at the end of that. All right. Questions so far? Okay. Moving on. Is this not too fast, is it? Okay. All right. So, verse 26. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. So right there is a very obvious reference to homosexuality, right? Yes. It's a sin. And both ways, women with women, men with men. That's all mentioned there. And it's shameless, he says. They're giving up natural relations. Now, a few things. Why does he specifically pull out homosexuality as an example of sexual sin here that is dishonoring your body? Why does he reference homosexuality here rather than, say, general promiscuity, which existed back then just like it does today? People sleeping around and cheating on their spouses and having affairs and all that kind of stuff. It was just as prevalent then as it is now. Why does he pick on homosexuality?
It has unintended consequences besides the two individuals. For instance, on families. And maybe even cities or something?
I think you're right.
Sodom and Gomorrah.
I think you're right. It has unintended consequences on the family and on society. That's true. We're going to read that article here in just a few moments, because this is our moment here where we're going to talk about homosexuality as a sin.
Wasn't there a particularly bad, there was a lot of it in Rome at that time?
Yes, it was very prominent. That's another reason, too, why Paul may have brought it up. It was a particularly pervasive sinfulness that was taking place at that time. We're probably approaching that in America.
So patently obvious.
Yeah, right. Another reason, and I don't know if that's what you meant by that statement just now, is homosexuality was very obvious.
Yeah.
Many sins are hidden, right? And for our own conscience, that's good. I don't want other people to see my sins. Keep in mind, God sees them all. God knows every one of your sinful actions, your sinful words, your sinful thoughts. God knows them all. But publicly, homosexuality was very obvious what was going on. And so it was a very public sin. So I think those are a number of reasons why Paul pulls up homosexuality here. Now, he says, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Women exchanged natural relations to what is contrary to nature, and men gave up natural relations consumed with one another. Here is one of the arguments that this is not about homosexuality. Well, there's a whole bunch of them, actually. There's six of them. Found these in the commentary. Some say the word nature is referring to what is inherent within you. So if you are born with a tendency to be a homosexual, which many of them claim they are, I was born this way. But Pastor, I was born this way. I was born with this tendency toward, you know, the same-sex relationships. So that's God's nature within me. That is one of the arguments they say. That this is about not going against your natural relation. So this is talking about what Paul is talking about. These are excuses. I'm going to give you six excuses or explanations about these two verses from people who reject the plain meaning of the text. One is, this is about heterosexuals should not engage in homosexual activity because it's against their nature. They were born as heterosexuals. But if you're born as a homosexual, then it's okay. That's one. Another one, number two, is this is about abusive relationships. Men committing shameless acts. It's about abusive relationships. If, on the other hand, you're not abusive and it's consensual, it's not a problem. Well, does this say that? It doesn't say that. Number three, this is about promiscuous behavior. If you're committed to one another in a civil union, or as, you know, our government seems to think it's okay to call it a marriage, if you're committed to one another, then it's okay. This is talking about dishonorable passions, meaning promiscuous behavior. That's a stretching of this text. That's not what it says. Another one is, well, Pastor, this is talking about idolatry. Because that's the paragraph above is, in fact, talking about idolatry. So this is talking about if you are holding up your sexuality as your own idol. That's what you're focused on in worshiping, is sexuality as an idol. Well, do people worship sexuality as an idol? Yes, it's true. But again, that's reading into this text what is not there, because Paul is talking about the specific act. All right, another one is, well, Paul just puts this in here because that was the social norms. The social norms back then were that you shouldn't engage in homosexual activity. It was looked down upon. Well, actually, the truth is the opposite. They accepted homosexual activity in the Greco-Roman culture. So you can't claim, well, this was just put in there from Paul in order to comply with social norms. No, actually, he wasn't. Another one is, well, Paul is just confronting judgmentalism. We shouldn't be judgmental of other people. We should accept them as they are. Well, that's nowhere in this text either. So those are all ways that some people, some theologians, twist this text to try and get it to say what they want it to say. Does that make sense? Here's one of my explanations or my responses to this. And I use alcoholism as an example, because there is some medical evidence that alcoholism might be at least partly genetic, that there might be a hereditary predisposition to being alcoholic if you have parents or grandparents who are alcoholic, you are more likely statistically to be alcoholic. Okay? So somebody can come to me and say, well, Pastor, I'm born this way. It's hereditary. I have a natural proclivity or inclination to get drunk all the time because I'm an alcoholic. So what? That's how God made me? I'm just going to comply with it. I'm just going to give in to it. And I would say, no, that's not how God made you. God originally made you and all humanity good and perfect. That's how sin corrupted your human nature, so that's not God's will. And even though you may claim, and maybe truthfully, were born that way, you still need to fight against that sinful tendency within you to get drunk all the time. So even though you may say, I have a natural, inherent inclination towards alcoholism, you fight against that. Now replace alcoholism with homosexuality. Well, Pastor, I was born this way. No. You may have been born that way, but that's not what God made you. That's what sin made you. And you need to fight against that tendency. You need to resist it. And frankly, every single one of us has multiple issues of this nature. It may not be homosexuality. It may not be alcoholism. But all of us are born with some natural sinful inclination buried within your soul and mine, towards greed, or towards selfishness, or towards gluttony, or towards laziness, or towards, pick a sin. All of you. Me too. Now, I'm not excluded. There are some, 1, 2, 3 sins that you have embedded within you that the devil knows. That is your weakness. That is your natural inclination towards that sin, whatever that sin is. God didn't make you that way. Sin made you that way, and you need to fight against it. And Paul is going to talk about that later in Romans. Fighting against it. You know it's coming up. You guys have heard it before. And if you've read the whole book, the good that I would do, I don't do. And the bad that I don't want to do, that's what I do. You know, it's kind of funny, the poetic nature of that. But it's true. We all have that. So I completely reject the idea that somebody says, Paul's not really talking about homosexuality here. He is. And I reject the idea that somebody says, well, God made me that way, so it's okay. No, that's not true. God didn't make you that way, and it's not okay. Now, another point to be made here, a little bit off this topic of this text, but that is, I think the Christian church in general, not necessarily Lutherans, although I think Lutherans have a little bit engaged in this too, have done ourselves a disservice by seeming to elevate homosexuality to a worse sin than any other sin. Okay? And I have admitted this to people who were upset about, well, why is the church harping on homosexuality so much? And I said, I agree with you. We shouldn't be. Yes, I'm not going to claim homosexuality is not a sin. I'm not going to do that because it clearly is a sin. However, I'm not going to say that it's somehow a worse sin than other sins. You know, you steal a candy bar from the store or you commit a homosexual act. Both are damning. Okay? And unfortunately, there is this impression out there among culture that Christians are very judgmental against homosexuals, which is partially true. We're judgmental against homosexuals because it's a sin, but we need to be equally judgmental against all sins. And frankly, a much more prominent problem in America is just the general promiscuity between straight people sleeping around all the time. I get tired of seeing it on the movies. You know, great movie, and then all of a sudden two characters sleep together. I'm like, why did they have to throw that in there? That has nothing to do with the storyline. I'm just watching Star Wars here. Leave me alone. You know, whatever. You get the point, right? Yeah, Rich.
Do you think people do that because it kind of subconsciously makes them feel better that their sins are not as bad as this sin?
You know, that's a good point. I think we like to grade sins and say, well, that sin's worse than mine, so I'm not as bad. And therefore they elevate homosexuality to a worse sin. Yeah, I think you're right.
Like the woman that was caught in adultery.
Yes, they did that with Jesus, the woman in adultery. Exactly right. Yep.
It could be that they attacked us first.
Well,
calling us bigots.
There is some of that.
And there is a response.
There is some of that, yes. Where there are some in the homosexual community, LGBTQ, that are attacking Christians. So in some sense, we need to defend ourselves.
They single us out.
Yeah.
We're an obvious target.
Yeah, yeah. Nancy, and then Eldon?
Kind of goes with what Glenn said. Is that at least currently, it's being thrown in our face all the time. Every show has to have a gay character.
Yeah, right.
And I think that that's why it comes up so often.
Yeah. Part of the reason it's become such a prominent issue in our culture is because of their side of it. They keep bringing it up, right? Yeah, that's very true. Eldon?
I was thinking about alcohol. You say too much is sin.
Right.
But just having a drink now and then, occasionally it may not be a sin.
Right.
But how do you know when you're sinning and when you're not?
Yeah. Yeah, like in terms of alcohol?
Yeah.
Or one could say, I mean, in terms of gluttony, you know, enjoy your food, but too much, you're being a glutton. So when you cross the line, I don't know. I would say your conscience will probably tell you. Like in drinking, I don't know if all of you drink or not. I do, I enjoy a beer. But I can tell, like if I've had a second drink, given my weight and size as a man, two drinks, I'm fine. If I start a third drink without having had something to eat, I can start to feel it a little bit in my head. And I'm like, oh, I'm coming up to that line. Nope, I'm going to stop after two beers or two glasses of wine. That's enough for me. You know, so I think you just have to know yourself and rely on your conscience. Where you cross that line into alcoholism or gluttony or any of those other abuses like that. So I don't have an answer for you, other than just pay attention to yourself.
I know some people want to drink to forget, and other people drink to remember.
Yeah! Right. Yeah, very true. All right. Anything else on this topic? I'm not going to read through this article. This article is very good. Again, this article is in your Lutheran Study Bible. If anybody's listening on the videotape, I'll have extra copies on the front counter here in our all-purpose room. And I do like the fact that at the end, the author of this does talk about how we need to recognize all sins and fight against all sins. And a homosexual, like any other sinner, needs to hear God's word of law and gospel applied to his or her life. So, there's a little, kind of brief talking there about how I think we do tend to wrongly elevate homosexuality as a worse sin than other sins. Okay? All right. I do have a quote from Martin Luther. Any questions? I do have a quote from Martin Luther for the end of verse 27 that kind of transitions us off the topic of homosexuality and then moving onward. And this also is in the footnotes of the Lutheran Study Bible, so if you've got that, it's at the end of the footnote under verse 27. Luther said this, "Holy Scripture declares that sin came from the devil, whom, contrary to God's word, our parents obeyed. They became disobedient to God, and thereby brought a terrible punishment upon themselves. For through this sin of the fall, not only our bodies have become so weakened that they have changed from immortal to mortal bodies, but the intellect, heart, mind, and will are entirely corrupted and turned evil. For man has lost the right and true knowledge of God. Moreover, his will is so entirely corrupted that he desires and wants nothing but that which is evil." So when Paul says here at the end of verse 27, receiving in themselves the due penalty of their error. When you commit a sinful act over and over again, kind of in a habitual way, whether it's alcoholism, addiction, drugs, homosexuality, promiscuity, any of those kind of habitual sins, you will receive in yourself the due penalty for your error, your sin. What does that mean? I think what Luther is talking about is it corrupts your mind. That's the due penalty of your sin. And I've taught this before. that the problem with habitual sins, not occasional sins, which we still need to fight against and repent of, but when you commit a sin habitually, what happens is you tend to drift into thinking it's no longer a sin. You become complacent with it. You don't fight against it. You don't recognize it as a sin. And now you have received the due penalty for your error because your conscience has become corrupted and your mental state has become corrupted. Okay, that's what Luther is talking about in that quote. The due penalty for your error. Okay? All right. Questions? Onward. Almost done. One short paragraph here left. Verse 28. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not be done. Now this is back more broadly. He used homosexuality as an example. Now he's talking about more broadly again. All sins, not founded in not acknowledging God. They did not see fit to acknowledge God. So just denying God's existence. This is where he started. With the wrath of God, right? In the beginning of sin is not acknowledging God. God gave them up. Third time, he gave them up. He says, are you sure? You sure? You really? Okay, I'll give you what you want. That's what God says. God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not be done. What does debased mean? I pondered this for a little bit. What does it mean to have a debased mind?
To be off base?
To be off base, sure.
Low. Lower thinking.
Lower thinking? Sure. Gutter thinking kind of thing, yeah. I pondered it a little bit. I actually kind of looked it up in a dictionary. Debased would mean undiscerning or undistinguishing. You cannot tell right from wrong. This kind of relates to that previous verse, doesn't it? It kind of flows. Because if you are stuck in a habitual sin, one of the due penalties of your error is your mind and conscience become corrupted. And so here, by not acknowledging God, you have a debased mind. You fail to see the difference between right and wrong. Undistinguishing. You can't distinguish between right and wrong. Does that happen in society today? Oh, yeah. All the time, doesn't it? And they, so in verse 29, he says, they were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. Wow, is that a condemning list, isn't it? And just in case you think that list doesn't apply to you, what jumps out at you right in the middle of that list? It always does for modern thinkers. What seems out of place in that list? What jumps out to you is like, really? You're going to include that in that list?
Gossips.
Oh, yeah? Well, gossips. I'm thinking disobedience to parents, but yes, gossips too. Gossips, really? Disobedient to parents? That's the same thing as doing all these other things? Yeah, it is. All sins condemn us. Now, I want to take just a few minutes, and then we'll wrap it up, to look at these in chunks, because that's how they are organized. You know, nothing's ever done randomly in the Bible. So, look at these in chunks. First of all, he says, they were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, and malice. They were filled, past tense. Because they failed to acknowledge God, because they deny God's existence, therefore, they became filled with these things. And now these are characteristics of the root of sin. Just like we talked about characteristics of God, grace and order and power and majesty and gentleness and all those characteristics of God, here's some characteristics of sin. unrighteousness, doing what is wrong, evil, just plain outright evil, covetousness or greed or wanting things, and malice. What is malice? I had to look it up. Wickedness, a desire to do bad things, a desire to do bad things. So, past tense, because they failed to acknowledge God, they were filled with this. Then, the next group is, they are full. Present tense. Because they have these foundational characteristics of sin, unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, and malice, therefore, they are now filled with envy, murder, strife, deceit, and maliciousness. And these can kind of be categorized, very obviously, other than murder, as an attitude within you. So you have the foundation of sin, which brings about an attitude of sin in the present. Envy. Nobody can see that you're envy. That's something that you know inside and God knows inside. Strife. The desire to argue or conflict with somebody. Deceit. Trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes. Trying to trick them. Maliciousness. The desire to do harm to somebody. And murder actually does kind of fit in this. Because even back then, and I looked it up in the Greek, there is a difference between murder and manslaughter. Back then, just like there is today. What is manslaughter? I'll ask a cop.
It's the unintentional killing of someone.
Right. And what is murder?
The intentional killing of someone.
So the difference is your intent. In other words, your attitude. They had the same difference back then in Greek culture, by the way. So murder really starts with an attitude of hate and intention to do harm. So, verse 29, those are your foundational characteristics. Then this next one, they are full of, these are sinful attitudes that exist within us. Then, what happens because of that? Oh, now here are some actions that come out of that. Here are things that occur because of that. Gossipers. Slanderers, speaking ill of somebody. Doesn't seem like a big sin, does it? Oh, is that really a big deal? I was just talking about those other people. Gossiping and slandering, that's not a big deal, is it? Hater of God. Insolent. What does insolent mean? I have to look up some of these just to kind of get a sense of them. Oh, I didn't write it down. What does insolent mean?
Defiant.
Okay. Defiant.
Lack of respect. Disrespectful.
Disrespectful. Goes with defiant, yeah. Okay. Doesn't seem like a very serious sin, does it? But it is. It flows out of these other things. Haughty. I don't like the word haughty. It's kind of like King James-ish. Haughty. I think of arrogance, right? Boastful. Proud of yourself in a bad way, probably. Boastful, kind of related to haughty. Inventors of evil. Oh my goodness. Do we in the modern era invent new ways to be evil? Especially with our technology, right? Oh yes, we can turn some good technology into bad technology. We'll invent the web and then turn it into the dark web. You know, where you can do all kinds of evil without being seen. Yeah, we're inventors of evil. Disobedient to parents. There we are again. It seems kind of out of place. What? Really? Disobedient to parents? Yeah. What it shows is, because the fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother, is the foundation of all authority. It's the first commandment of the second table of the commandments. And again, it's foundational. Just like the first commandment is foundational, the fourth commandment is foundational. Because this is an attitude of rebellion. And if you're going to rebel against your parents, who are you going to rebel against next? Your government, your authorities, and eventually God. Okay. Then these last four. Here's this last, verse 31. So this is kind of the summary of this conclusion. And this final group is kind of a description of the results. Of the results of all of this sinfulness. Because of this, what is the result? You end up, and notice there is a little kind of poetic nature to this in English, which is good because it actually that exists in the Greek too. I looked it up. Foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Kind of rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Because we do all of this stuff, we are foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Foolish. Fool. What does a fool do? He does things for now, doesn't care about the future. We are unconcerned about consequences. That's a fool. Faithless. We do things without regard to what God desires. Okay? Heartless. We have no mercy or concern for other people. Completely focused on us, me, what I want. I don't care about other people. You're heartless. You're unemotional. You're uncompassionate. Ruthless. You do things just because you want to. Darn it. I'm not going to do anything for anyone else. You're just ruthless about it. You see all of those as being characteristics that come out of sinful attitudes and sinful actions? So there's really like four lists buried within this bigger list, okay? And they are grouped kind of in ways of meaning there. All right, I'm going to wrap this up. I do want to finish a little bit early. I'm trying to only be like an hour and a quarter to these Bible studies instead of like a full hour and a half. I have a quote for you from Dr. Middendorf, the writer of this commentary, about this. He says this, I thought this was rather insightful. The ever-shifting ruminations of a postmodern society probably provide the ultimate illustration of the degree to which cultural approval or disapproval heavily impacts the practice of or abstention from numerous activities, such as greed, abortion, sexual immorality, premarital sex, cohabitation, homosexual conduct, pornography, swearing, divorce, family abandonment, lying, slander, and gossiping. All too often, the surrounding society, which is simply comprised of the individuals within it, holds up those who do these things depicted by Paul and holds them up as stars and celebrities. They then become role models for imitation. He's referring to this last verse here, where we sum it up. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice these things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval. He's talking about all these bad things, and he lists some of the sinful things going on in our society right now. Did you hear that list in the midst of this quote? All of those things are prevalent. And he's saying the problem is, in our society, is that we hold up stars and athletes and famous people and leaders who do those bad things, and that gives approval and promotes those bad activities, those sinful activities. That's the problem. I see that as absolutely true. You know, we hold up people for the wrong reasons. And because of that, sometimes when they're filled with some kind of corrupted or sinful habit or activity, and yet they are held up with honor, you know, in fame and society or whatever, and it ends up promoting those sinful activities. Okay? To tie this all up, just as a conclusion then, this is interesting. Those who practice such things deserve to die. What is the number one consequence of sin? Death. It's not foolishness, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. Those are consequences of sin. Because we sin, you and I sin, we are part of this too, because I'm willing to bet all of you at some point disobeyed your parents. I'm willing to bet all of you at some point gossiped a little bit. I did. We've probably slandered people. I mean, we could go through this list. How many of us were arrogant or boastful at some point, and maybe still are? And because of these sins, which apply to all of us, all sins are condemning, we are, as a result, foolish, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. But that's not the worst part of it. The worst part of it is we deserve to die. God didn't want us to die. He created us to be immortal. Death is the worst consequence of sin. He's going to talk even more coming up about death. And it drives home the point that that's the number one consequence of sin that Jesus had to come and overcome, come to earth and overcome for us. Okay. Questions? Comments? Yeah, there's a lot of heavy law here. Law, you know, as Lutherans especially, we know that, you know, there's law and gospel all through the Bible. Well, in the book of Romans, you can pretty much divide it up. Here's the law, and here's the gospel. And we're in that section where here's the law. So, the gospel is coming. But yes, this part that Paul is writing here and the next chapter is intended to make us realize how sinful we are. We need to know that and remember that, or else we won't want to be forgiven. We won't cling to faith in Jesus. Okay. No questions, comments?
I think we have to work harder as homosexuals to make them see that that life choice is a sin in God's eyes. But I think too often we make them feel that they're bad, that they're unlovable, that they don't belong in the Christian church, and we have to separate the sin from the person.
Yeah, I agree. How do you delicately tell somebody who says, claims they're homosexual, that, well, what you do is sinful, but you know what? You're still welcome among God's people. You know, God loves you. Jesus died for you. You're forgiven, and your sin is, while it's a sin, it's the same as my sin. My sin of greed or gluttony or whatever. And that's a very delicate thing in our society today. In fact, even if you just try to delicately enter a conversation like that, maybe with a friend or neighbor who's claiming they're gay or whatever, you'll get lambasted for it. That is the right approach, but it's very, very difficult. It's very, very difficult. Yeah. Okay, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thanks for coming. Have a good night.